Welcome to Protecting Project Pulp, part of the District of Wonders Network, featuring Starship Sofa, Tales to Terrify, and Crime City Central. Everyone has a story in the District of Wonders. Come and find yours.
This is Protecting Project Pulp, episode 52. I'm your host, Simon Hildebrandt. Welcome to the show. This week we bring you Metaphory by Eric H. Wilkinson, narrated by Josh Roseman. One quirk of our chosen field to keep in mind is that many pulp series were ghost-written by several authors through their runs, and due to the dubious reputation attached to pulp publication, many authors use pseudonyms, making the process of tying an author confidently to a story difficult at the best of times. Also, due to their veracity, pulp magazines took stories more readily than, say, a big novel publisher, and more than one author was published just once in some pulp rag and never heard from again. So it's not too surprising that, apart from this week's story, published in the August 1929 edition of Sea Stories magazine, we know very little of Eric H. Wilkinson. A novel, Crossroads of Destiny, is also credited to him, and was also published in 1929, but beyond that, he's a cipher. We know considerably more about our narrator. Josh Roseman, not the trombonist, the other one, lives in Georgia, the US state, not the country. His writing has appeared in Asimov's Escape Pod and the cross-genres anthology Fat Girl in a Strange Land. His fiction has been reprinted by the Doonstief Audio Fiction magazine and Starship Sofa, and his voice has been heard on two of the Escape Artists and all four of the District of Wonders podcasts. When not writing, he mostly complains about the fact that he's not writing. Find him online at roseplusman, or one word, .com, or on Twitter at listener42. So prepare for a tale of sword and sail, sort of. It's Metaphory by Eric H. Wilkinson, narrated by Josh Roseman.
Sailors, whose observation is necessarily keener than that of other men, and who have to name the wonders they encounter for future reference, have always called him the swordfish, when they did not call him something worse. And they have known about him for a long time, a very long time. Doubtless in prehistoric ages, the Cro-Magnons, drifting round the coast of Spain in their frail cockle shells, knew him. Although, since the sword had not yet come into use as an offensive weapon, they probably called him the equivalent of the fish to be avoided if possible. Later, the Phoenicians, the founders of the mercantile marine, became quite familiar with him. Not too familiar, for they took care to give him as wide a berth as possible. And perhaps the Cretans, the first to develop fighting ships, learned a wrinkle or two in tactics from him, and equipped their ships with rams, conceived in flattering imitation of his sword, stout-based, sharp-tipped, and serrated on the lower edge to prevent the prey from escaping when once impaled. Today, armed with harpoons, Mediterranean fishing fleets hunt for him, for his flesh is very palatable, and the sword, varnished and made up into such vanities as walking sticks or fire guard supports, will always fetch a few pieces of silver from curio hunting tourists. Even so, the hunted will sometimes turn on the hunter, and woe betide the light fishing smack or dinghy once a full-grown swordfish has decided to attack. Imagine a 3-foot spike, as solid and unbreakable as ivory, and driven by the combined force of 10 men, each armed with a sledgehammer. What chance has a small boat against such a weapon which can and has been known to pierce the hull of a 4-masted ship? Take 9 feet of bone and muscle weighing some 600 pounds, driven by a strength greater in proportion than that of any other fish. Equip it with the above weapon, which is really a prolongation of the skull, and so part of the rugged frame, and not merely attached. Add a furious temper and utter lack of fear, and you have the Mediterranean or Atlantic swordfish. Double all this, including the fearlessness and temper, and you have the giant swordfish of the Indo-Pacific. Metaphory, the natives of the South Seas called him. Perhaps some scientist had tried to teach them his classical name, and this was the nearest pronunciation they could get to Histiophorus Ziphius Histiophorus. His original home, as a youngster, was New Zealand, or rather the densely populated waters around the coast of the North Island, where, even when quite small, he wrought havoc among the schools of mullet and lesser fry. Scorning carrion, for he was no scavenger and preferred to kill his own food, he began hunting at a very early age, thereby developing the wonderful strength and speed which later was to be both danger and salvation to him. Nor did he have many enemies, except those which his own quick temper and utter fearlessness incurred. Sharks he despised. They were arrant cowards as a rule, although they could occasionally put up a fair fight when forced to it. But they were garbage hounds, preferring the leavings of others to hunting their own. Poor trash. Perhaps his dislike was partly due to the fact that they were a humble relation of his, claiming kinship on account of the similarity of their skins, scaleless, leathery skins. In the case of the sharks, so rough that it was like the surface of a wood rasp. But here, all similarity ended. Excluding, of course, his sword, Metoffrey was heavier and stockier in proportion. His remarkable tail, unlike the more or less single tapering affair belonging to the shark family, was bifurcated from base to tip, a design to which he partly owed the unerring aim and speed of his charges. His dorsal fin, instead of being the comparatively small triangular-shaped wedge, as in the shark tribe, extended the whole length of his back, and, when hoisted, equaled in height the diameter of his body. The extraordinary size and his use of this fin has gained for him his other, though less popular, name of sailfish. One fine morning, fine for that coast of fierce gales and mighty seas, Metoffrey was taking a little cruise, his tail spread to its full extent to catch a light easterly breeze, which, without any effort on his part but a slight adjustment of his rudder, carried him at about 4 or 5 knots down the coast. Now and then he caught sight of a wandering cow and other smaller fish, which, had he wanted, he could have taken easily. But this morning he had hopes of surprising a school of mullet, his favorite sport, and, incidentally, his preference on the menu. Once a huge black shadow glided across his course many feet below him, and Metoffrey imperceptibly checked his speed, ready to dart aside should the giant stingery suspect that the apparently lifeless piece of driftwood above him was worthwhile investigating. Metoffrey had seen a fight between one of his own people and a stingery, and before the sharks had demolished the victim, he had come close enough to observe the hideous wounds which the giant sea bat's scorpion-like tail had inflicted on the loser, observed, and taken notice for future reference. Pugnacious little ruffian though he was, even at that early age, he was no fool, and he realized glumly that his experience, as yet, was not sufficient to cope with a fish. At least, he supposed it was a fish. Anyway, it swam, which recognized no rules of the game, but fought with its tail. Somewhat relieved when the stingery vanished as mysteriously as it had appeared, Metoffrey hoisted sail again and proceeded on his course. Suddenly, as he rounded a point, he came upon a school of mullet playing in the sheltered waters of a little bay. As he had hoped, his arrival was a complete surprise to the school. Fish are very sensitive, not only to sight, but to vibration. Had Metoffrey been hurrying, they would doubtless have heard, or rather felt him, even before they saw him, but his effortless approach, little more than drifting, deceived the sentinels of the school until he was almost among them. Reefing his sail with a snap, which added impetus to his charge, Metoffrey dove headlong at the school with such speed and deadly aim that he impaled 3 victims on his 2-foot skewer before the school broke up in fluttering panic and scattered to the 4 currents. Quite satisfied with the result, Metoffrey shook his victims off. Not such an easy job, for the lower edge of his sword was serrated, the rudimentary remains of what in ages past had been teeth, and leisurely dined. Nevertheless, he kept his eyes open as a silver streak emerged from the shelter of the point and hurtled past him after the scattered mullet. But the latter had already gained cover, and the silver streak, a stalking barracuda which had been biding his time, waiting for the mullet to come a bit closer to him, returned, bitterly disappointed, to his post. seeing Mitofri and knowing that he was the cause of his discomfiture, the sea tiger paused, baring his teeth and twitching his tail angrily. Mitofri was quite ready, gulping down the third mullet with a relish calculated to goad his rival still further. He swung around until his sword pointed directly at the crouching tiger. In fact, had the barracuda delayed another instant, Mitofri would probably have attacked first. But the former, though furious, was not yet ready to commit suicide. He was no coward. In fact, next to Mitofri, he was the fiercest and most reckless of all sea fish. But Mitofri had the advantage, a deadly sharp 2-foot advantage, plus extra weight, for the sea pike would have scaled 60-odd pounds, whereas Mitofri was nearer 100 by now. With a soundless snarl, the luckless sea tiger darted, obliquely, so that if Mitofri attacked, his aim would be more difficult, into the shelter of a submarine cavern behind the point. Rather disappointed, for he was spoiling for a fight, Mitofri circled slowly and tauntingly in front of the cave mouth. But finding that he could not tempt the barracuda to try conclusions with him, he departed, leaving a piece of mullet tail for the barracuda to see, by way of a kindly afterthought. Barracudas are not scavengers either, and bitterly resent such an imputation. His own temper, which was exceedingly short, beginning to rise at the thought of losing an enjoyable fight, he sullenly toured around the little bay, although he knew the scattered mullet would have given warning, and no game was likely to be found. The appearance of what at first sight he took to be a piece of driftwood, but which he presently saw could apparently move slowly in any direction it desired, provoked his easily aroused curiosity, and he swam over for a closer inspection. Only its size, although but a little wider, it was almost 3 times his own length, prevented him from attacking immediately. Moreover, its extreme slowness made him suspicious. The stingery had taught him that it was well to know an enemy opponent's tactics before starting anything. As nothing further happened, in fact, from its increased speed, it seemed that the creature was feebly trying to escape from him if possible, Mitofri made a complete circle around it, just to be sure there was no funny stuff, before he charged. Suddenly, his attention was drawn to a small, shiny object about 3 inches long, in reality a fishing spinner of pearl shell, which bobbed and sidled behind the creature, gradually drawing closer to it, yet apparently quite unconcerned at Mitofri's approach. Mitofri was annoyed, then enraged. According to all previous experience, this miserable little fish should have dashed away in panic at his approach. But instead of that, it bobbed leisurely along as if, trusting in the protection of the bigger creature, it was actually trying to mock him. Protection. Huh. Snapping down his sail, Mitofri charged, his sword striking the canoe squarely in the middle just at the waterline. Had the Maori fisherman not been sitting in the stern, he might have received a serious, if not fatal, injury, for Mitofri's sword penetrated the shell of the canoe up to its hilt. This was the fisherman's salvation, for, as he dived overboard and struck out desperately for the shore, some 200 yards away, Mitofri was too occupied in extricating himself from the wrecked canoe, which clung persistently around his nose, to notice anything else. At first he backed away, but the canoe, though nearly waterlogged, was so light that its resistance was not sufficient for the serrated saw to disengage itself. Frightened, for the first time in his life, he tried shaking himself like a dog, with no more success, for the canoe merely gave with him, without the hole becoming enlarged. It was lucky for him that the barracuda did not come out to investigate the disturbance, for he was completely disarmed and helpless. Perhaps some thought such as this may have entered his head, for, thoroughly panic-stricken by now, he made for the shelter of the rocky point on the farther side of the bay. This was his salvation, for as he tried to back into a deep shelter, the ends of the canoe caught on the rocks, and with this leverage to pull against, Mitofri easily rid himself of his encumbrance, so easily that he sat somewhat violently against the unyielding rocks behind him. Finding himself free, he made for the outer sea, the wide open spaces where fish are fish. In fact, never again did he hunt so close to the shore. Soon, his spirits returned. Fear was unnatural to him, and he never stayed long. But remembrance of the canoe remained. Apparently, there were some things so darned helpless that they were positively dangerous. Lunch off a sea trout, a rare but delicious course, completely restored his self-confidence, and he ventured on southward. A few days later, he came to another bay, so deep and wide that the shore in the center was almost invisible from midway between the two points. Here he encountered a small outward-bound steamer. Matofri eyed it suspiciously. Apparently, though 1,000 times bigger, its habits were somewhat similar to the helpless creature which had given him such a shock. It never dived, but moved slowly on top of the surface with such labored effort that the vibration could be felt for miles around. Nor, on seeing him, did it veer from its course either toward or away from him. Moreover, a couple of sharks were following it within easy charging distance, so that there could be no danger whatever from the thing itself, only from its sheer darned helplessness, no doubt. Matofri scowled as it passed him, horribly tempted to give it a vicious jab, but prudently restrained himself. The revolving and pulsing of the screws puzzled him. He could understand a creature's motive power being in its tail. That was only natural. But why make such a fuss about it? One or two similar creatures, little larger than the canoe, but white in color, were also moving about the bay, sluggishly driven by their tails. However, none of the other fish seemed to mind them. In fact, the mullet were fairly plentiful, but so scattered that catching them was not easy. Urged on by his insatiable appetite, Matofri persevered with fair success. Once he spotted a mullet, alive but either injured or oblivious of any danger, so slowly was it moving. Still hungry, or else he might have been more suspicious, Matofri made for it, not troubling to spear such an easy captive, but seizing it in his jaws. A sharp prick in the side of his mouth annoyed rather than alarmed him, and he discovered that to the mullet was attached a piece of weed, so thin and yet so tough that he could not bite through it. With the idea of shaking it off, Matofri broke water. "Look out, sir, you've hooked a small un," said one of the men of the launch. The other, a lean, sun-browned man seated aft in a pivoting chair, nodded, frowning as he hastily examined his reel. "I know, this confounded reel is going to jam again, I'm afraid. He's off, sir, he's off!" Matofri had been surprised, and still more annoyed at his failure to shake off the weed. Then, suddenly finding that not only had the pain in his mouth increased, but that he was slowly yet surely moving against his will toward the launch, he turned, and with all the speed and strength of which he was capable, dashed blindly in the opposite direction. Not until he began to tire did he again feel that weak but insistent pull on his mouth. Then, for a second time, fear came to his rescue and lent him strength to continue his headlong rush. Then there came a jerk which turned him almost completely around in his tracks, followed by a fierce stabbing pain in his mouth. A moment later he realized that he was free, the weed was gone, and with it that intolerable, persistent pull toward the launch. A quick dive and he was down, far down in the shadowy depths, where he could fill his panting gills and aching mouth with refreshingly ice-cold water. "Lost him, thanks to this damn reel," sighed the lean, sun-browned man resignedly. "Sporting little chap, too. I'd like to get into him again some day." Perhaps it was lucky for some launch that Matofri's experience of them at such an early age had been so unpleasant. He connected the clinging weed as being due in some way to the launch. Doubtless he would have been caught sooner or later, but had he been hooked again, his fury would have made him charge, and even a motor launch is not improved by being perforated in the hull. As it was, Matofri left, hurriedly, for the north again. He had had enough adventures for the time being, and here, far from the popular fishing grounds, in fact, out of the course of any ship save an occasional coastal tramp or trading schooner, he grew and thrived. For several years, he led a quiet and uneventful life, making an occasional 100-mile jaunt, but never southward, and usually in the mating season, for swordfish, when seen far from land, are generally in couples. As time went on, he found it more and more difficult to satisfy his appetite, which increased in ratio to his size. At last, he decided to pull up stakes and move to more populous waters where the fish were bigger and would not necessitate so many per square meal. By this time, he was about 13 feet in length, of which the sword comprised 3/10, and weighed over 1,000 pounds. His dorsal sail, which as a youngster had been all one piece, was now divided into two, the sign of maturity, a magnificent specimen of Pacific swordfish. Matoffrey, at first, had no definite ideas as to his ultimate destination, but his local forages had taught him that the farther north, the better hunting. And so, one fine morning in January, midsummer in the south, he set out, heading north by east, accompanied by a stalwart matron who had been won in a glorious fight, for, like that other game fish, the salmon, swordfish are temporarily monogamous. For 2 or 3 weeks, they proceeded leisurely through the rapidly warming water, sailing wherever the wind permitted, and taking the lower trails when the surface conditions were unfavorable. To keep in trim, they chased schools of flying fish, whose proportionately huge lateral fins, like wings, enabled them to elude their pursuers by skipping from swell to swell just above the surface. Occasionally, they managed to impale one before it could take to the air, or was too exhausted to fly for any distance. But, stripped of their wings, they were little larger than a herring, and even bonier, and decidedly less palatable. A couple of 100 miles past Fiji, they saw in the distance a big bull whale, which had been cut off from the main herd by a school of killer whales, who set upon the brute whenever he came up for air, like a pack of wolves attacking a giant elk. But the whale, though sorely harassed, was still strong. The furious killers could do little damage to him below the surface. In fact, they rarely tried, and on his brief trips to the surface for air, they had a hard time of it at first. The powerful brute would occasionally catch a luckless 30-foot killer, and, with a flip of his mighty flukes, hurl it with stunning force to fall some 50 yards or so away. Matoffrey quivered with anticipation as he took in the details of the fight. Although he had never encountered a whale before, age-old instinct told him that he was needed here, and what to do. Followed by his wife, he dived until he reached a point some 20 fathoms immediately below the giant cetacean. The next time the brute dived to escape the furies, the two swordfish attacked him from below, burying their swords to the hilts in the descending mountain of flesh, easily extricating themselves afterward with a twist from the soft, yielding blubber. Goaded by these stings, the unhappy whale rose hastily to the surface, only to be driven down again by the waiting pack. Half a dozen times he tried to submerge, each time his dive becoming shallower as Matoffrey and his wife, seeing their victim weaken, grew bolder and lessened the length of their charge. At last the whale, exhausted with his efforts and wounds, floated, dying on the surface, and the pack closed in, tearing the still quivering bulk to pieces. Matoffrey and his wife joined in the feast, unmolested by the killers, who seemed to recognize the assistance they had given. Although a greedy shark, one of a horde who were prudently waiting until the slayers had finished, paid with his life for his impatience. Gorged with this rich meal, Matoffrey was thankful to be able to set sail and travel without much exertion on his part for the next day or so. Twice more during his voyage he encountered, and was lucky enough to assist killers, each resulting banquet making him more and more determined to push on, in spite of the remonstrances of his wife, who, for the sake of the future generation, was anxious to make shoal waters. At last, he came to a pass between two islands, a very deep pass about 4 miles wide, through which traveling hordes of fish made use of the strong currents. Bounding the pass and surrounding the islands were coral reefs, beyond which, on an occasional foray in search of Ophi, the octopus, a new and delightful delicacy which he had discovered during his voyage, he caught a glimpse of canoes drifting on the lagoon. Although he never ventured into the lagoons, it was from no fear of the canoes, even if he had remembered the incident of his younger days. His strength and size were now so great that to demolish a canoe would be but the work of a second. But Matoffrey was by preference a deep-sea fish. His hulk and charging tactics demanded plenty of room. Moreover, Each time he ventured close to the coral cliffs, he had the same imprisoned feeling which a backwoodsman experiences when visiting a city. However, Mitofri decided that this particular corner of the ocean was as near to his ideal as he could ever hope to find. A sea of eternal summer, tempered with occasional rains and winds, which, compared to those in the far south, were but little more than sailing breezes. Nor was it attacked by that dread menace of the tropics, the hurricane. He was soon joined by other swordfish seeking a marine utopia. At least, they also hunted the pass, but refrained from getting too close to Mitofri. His temper and size precluded any attempt at sociability. However, there were plenty of tarahi and paiheri, besides countless other smaller courses on the menu, so, provided they did not interfere with him, he was content to suffer their presence. As the years passed, although he had long since reached maturity, Mitofri still increased in size until he was almost 3/4 of a ton in weight, 17 feet of steel-muscled, undisputed power, king of the seas, demanding and receiving tribute by reason of his 5-foot scepter. Rarely did he have to use it as a sword now, the mere sight of it being sufficient to scatter in panic the most unruly of his subjects. One day, as he loafed through a sapphire sea so calm that except for the eternal Pacific swell, it might have been some huge landlocked lagoon, he passed near a trim white launch. Mitofri scarcely heeded it, except to notice that it was somewhat out of its course. He was accustomed to seeing the daily passenger and mail launches from Tahiti to Moorea laboriously breast the swells and choppy seas off Cook's Point. They never interfered with him, nor even spoiled his hunting. Neither did the occasional liner or copra schooners, hurrying through the pass on their own business. But what did attract his attention was the peculiar antics of a fair-sized paiheri, a large and very succulent variety of mackerel to which he was particularly addicted. Paying no heed to the awful presence of His Majesty, the paiheri cavorted and bounded about like some playful little trout at the first fly hatch of the season, instead of concentrating his energies on the usual single-minded dash for safety. Mitofri's sight may have weakened, but it is more likely that his absolute supremacy had obviated any need for suspicion. Whatever the reason, he failed to notice the slender strand of copper wire attached to the paiheri. Displeased with such impudent frivolity, more especially since he was quite in the mood for the gentle exercise which normally preceded a light snack of this sort, he gulped down the offender, and then, perhaps the almost insignificant prick of the hook may have struck some dim chord in his memory. Certainly, the tautening of the line in a feeble strain of some 50 pounds or so was no more than a slight discomfort to him, and had about as much effect in controlling his movements as a clothesline would have on a wild elephant. For a moment he lay still, literally paralyzed, so great was the shock of anger at the realization that he, Mitofri, king of the sea, had been subject to such an enormity. Then, his fury tempered by the absurdity of attempting to hamper his movements or freedom, he dived. Not the blind, panic-stricken dash of the past, but a steady downward glide, wonderfully fast, in spite of the lack of effort. On board the launch, a lean, sunburned man, whose dark hair was now graying slightly about the temples, tensed as the screech of the reel shrilled a call for action, and a smile flickered for an instant across his tightly compressed lips, the grim smile of a fighter who has met a worthy opponent. For several seconds, the reel, an enormous affair capable of holding several hundred yards of line, howled with protest against such terrific speed, and the fighter frowned as he saw that his reserves of line were rapidly becoming exhausted. Soon, to his relief, the howl of the tortured brakes diminished to a creaking purr, and finally stopped. There is a limit to which even such a giant as Mitofri may descend, for, though a deep-sea fish, he was a surface hunter. His lungs were not constructed to withstand the enormous pressure of the lower depths any more than those of a man will permit him to ascend far into the rarefied atmosphere above. Winded by his effort, Matafri rose, slowly at first, and then, astounded that the slight but persistent pull on his head still remained, his fury got the better of his reason. Had he continued to swim leisurely away from the launch, it would have been a matter of seconds until he was free. As it was, he rose with a superb rush, which carried him 20 feet out of the water, where, for the fraction of a second, he poised, his body arched in midair, shaking his head with a magnificent fury wonderful to see, to fall with a splash which sent inquisitive spectators darting to cover. Then, changing his tactics, he tore off at right angles with all the speed of which he was capable, and dived. But the lean, sunburned man had also learned a lot, more than any other whose favorite sport was big-game fishing. Many a time, single-handed, he had fought and beaten a fish 5 times his own weight, fighting it with rod and line which he himself could easily have broken, had he wished. As Matafri rose, his enemy rapidly and skillfully reeled in the slack, so that when Matafri returned from his brief flight to his own element once more, he still felt that slight check, maddening in its terrible persistency. Once more he broke water, only to fail in his purpose. "Heavens!" ejaculated a friend of the hunters, who had been driven speechless by Matafri's first appearance. "What a whopper! What a whopper! You'll never tire him out, Gray! Shall I lend you a hand?" "No," said the hunter firmly. "It's between him and me." It seemed almost as if Matafri heard him, or perhaps it was just the spirit of one fighter calling to another. At any rate, there ensued a battle royale worthy of any king, an age-old struggle in which man pitted his skill and wits against brute strength. For 3 long hours, Matafri tried every trick he knew. But always the hunter managed to maintain his hold, although the sweat poured from him and the lines of his face betrayed the agony which the constant strain on his arms exacted. But Matafri was in even worse shape. Just as a comparatively light weight becomes an intolerable burden after a time, so had the slight pull on his head become a resistless drag to which, exhausted by his own futile efforts to escape it, he was gradually succumbing. At last, after summoning all his failing strength for one final dash for freedom, he lay spent and beaten on the surface. Had he known it, he was within an ace of freedom, for this last charge had taken him 1/4 mile from the launch, and but a few scant yards of line remained on the reel. "Quick!" gasped the hunter to his friend. "That other spool! I'll splice it on! He's beat, I think, but I daren't pull on him, or he might have another spurt left in him!" Still maintaining the strain, the hunter began to attach the extra line, but just as the actual splicing began, he was forced to relax the strain for a moment or two. Matafri, rolling helplessly on the surface, subconsciously felt the strain relax, and, although he was past caring, some instinct, not waiting for orders, urged him to a feeble switch of his tail, sufficient to carry him on, only for a few yards farther, but enough. In vain, the hunter made a grab at the line as it slipped through the guiding rings of his rod. Had he caught it, he might still have won, for Matafri had not the strength of an average salmon by now. As it was, the line went overboard, where it floated tantalizingly on the surface, just out of reach. And then, as Matafri mechanically dived, a poor, weak effort more like a gradual submerging than a dive, both line and fish vanished.
"Lord, what rotten luck! You had him! I'll swear you had him!" groaned the friend, whose disappointment seemed greater than that of the hunter himself.
"Yes, but you see, I didn't," said the latter sadly, relaxing with a sigh of relief, for he was very, very tired.
"I wonder the brute didn't charge the launch, though I suppose we would have got him if he had," observed the friend.
"Still, it wouldn't have done the launch any good."
The hunter smiled. A successful writer, whose stories were known the world over, the loss of a launch would not have distressed him much. In fact, he would cheerfully have sacrificed the value of a launch for the chance of another bout with Matafri.
"No, it wouldn't," he admitted. "But I'm glad he didn't. I'd have hated to have to harpoon the old boy. No, Jim, it was a good fight, and the best man won. But..." he added wistfully. "It isn't often that one has the chance of getting into such a fish. Must have been around 1500, I should judge. Jim, I wonder if he'll give me another go at him." "I doubt it," said the friend. But could the game old king, slowly recovering his strength in the cool depths, have heard, it is more than probable he would have accepted the challenge.
That was Metaphory by Eric H. Wilkinson, narrated by Josh Roseman. This is a whole new angle on pulp for me, a typical fishing story turned inside out, if you will. And while I had my doubts at the start, I was pleasantly surprised at how engrossing life described from a fish's eye view could be. And thanks to our narrator Josh, who took on a unique narrating challenge. If you were hooked on this story, then drop by the site at protectingprojectpulp.com and leave a comment on the episode post, or join the conversation in the District of Wonders forum, linked from the site. And while you're there, don't forget to subscribe to the show via iTunes or your podcast app of choice. Just click the subscribe link. Thanks for listening from everyone here at PPP. Our assistant editor, Fred Heimbaugh, our sound engineer, Tom O'Dwyer, our producer, Tony C. Smith, and from me, your host, Simon Hildebrandt. We hope you'll join us next time for episode 53, where we'll bring you The Hand of the Mandarin Kwong by Sax Rohmer, narrated by Doc Coleman. So take a moment to consider how it traveled to reach your plate next time you dine on fish, and have a great week.
This presentation has been brought to you by the District of Wonders Network, dedicated to podcasting the finest genre fiction. You can learn more about the District of Wonders and their many literary productions at their website, www.districtofwonders.com. Thank you for listening.